Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Rachel. How are you doing?
You know, I'm not the woman that you thought I was. I have a dark, sordid past.
What? Do we have to make an example out of you?
Yes.
You
have to never let me watch Star Trek Discovery again.
What's that? Let you watch it over and over again as an example of your punishment. Okay. Before we leap off into anything of the usual variety, obviously I'm Ryan, you're Rachel. I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much, Rachel, for letting me host this with you. You see, when I was a small child, I lived in rural Australia in a town in which, oh boy, there was a flood one time. And that really is poignant to the story that we're going to be delving into in this podcast. I mean, I just wanted to make sure that we stopped everything, stopped the halt and momentum of diving in and reviewing and rewatching and all of that stuff of Discovery, just to let you know, thanks for including me. And not only that, thank you for including me, a character who does indeed have a backstory, a host, a person who does indeed have a thing that has happened to them. It makes me have a third dimension. In fact, can we all give a clap to that? So brave. So brave that I'm here after that flood in my hometown in rural Australia. Did I also mention I've saved a baby one time? It's worth a 5-star review at least. Rachel, we're yum-yum, likingly, because we're always yumming and we both happen to be on a podcast.
I don't like that. I don't like what you did there. I don't appreciate it. I know Bartek has a special place in your heart.
Yeah, that is an intro to my other podcast, Spit and Polish Presents. Yum yum. Explain it, Rach. For those uninitiated, for those who have forgotten what yum yum is and what we do here.
Here on this podcast, which has nothing to do with you being Polish, we rewatch science fiction shows and analyze them, evaluate, review them. And at the moment, we are making our way through the swamp of awfulness and terror that is season 4 of Star Trek Discovery. And I look forward to returning to our Babylon 5 coverage.
Don't worry, the Babylon 5 coverage is still happening, Rach. We're just taking the detour today to record and discuss this.
I know that it's happening, but I want it to be happening right now instead of this.
Okay, I mean, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm here to give, dude.
Are there going to be spoilers?
Yes.
I don't know.
There will be spoilers
bound.
But everybody should know, regardless of spoilers, regardless of feelings.
Regardless of context, which is for kings.
Nah, you can do it now.
You really hate the context is for kings thing, don't you? Don't worry. Yum Yum is a moment that Rachel loves. It's when Commander Narn, who was once an engineer, like so many characters in this series of Star Trek Discovery, does it ever come up at any point? No. She was introduced as an engineer, but she never does any engineering at any point. Isn't that funny? It's like, why did they even bother mentioning it in the first place? It was something to mention. But she was helping Empress Georgiou, remember that fun character? Can't wait for that Section 31 show. She was helping her murder the antagonist of that season, and Georgiou asked if she wanted to proceed to make him scream, and instead of saying yes or something normal, She said a line that the writers deemed worthy of not only putting down, but approving and getting the actress to read. Yum, yum. Rachel adores that moment. She tugged at my my sleeve and said, "Ryan, can we name the podcast after that?" And I nodded and said, "Yes, yes, we may." And that's what we're here to do. Look at that yum yum moment and apply it to every episode of Discovery, as well as just talking about them. What one are we delving into today, Rachel? What episode of Discovery did we rewatch?
We rewatched The Examples.
Oh, The Examples. Oh, what an episode.
Yeah. Comes in at a 5.8.
Well, out of 5? That's like a whole pointage above. Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Absolutely, that's it. Burnham and Book race to evacuate a group of stranded colonists in the anomaly's path as one of the Federation's brightest scientists. Definitely not a villain.
Not the villain that they said wouldn't be in the season.
Comes aboard.
Oh.
The USS Discovery to do high stakes research with Saru and Stamets.
Yeah, high stakes. I mean, it is the closest Paul did come to killing the crew of Discovery, which is pretty rich. But in all fairness, Jet Reno wasn't there in season one to see all the times he nearly killed the entire crew of Discovery, so I'll give Jet a pass on that comment.
I genuinely forgot that was Tig's name.
Jet Reno? What a name. What a character. Can we give it up for Jet Reno, people? So brave. So brave that Tig Notaro doesn't even try. Again, Tig Notaro and Cronenberg are my favorite in this because they're here for the money and it's a mild inconvenience to film. And so, and you see it visibly on their faces. It's adorable. It's what I truly adorable. Tell me your story with this.
Do I have one?
I don't know.
Other than I watched it a couple of months ago. And I was like, oh, okay, then we're doing this. We're doing a sanctioned jailbreak episode?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the first episode that breaks the distinct pattern of like a diplomacy mission. Political-based mission and then action-based mission.
The president didn't really factor in
no,
this episode.
No, this one it was science.
Morality.
And a mission.
Yeah, and the mission involved kind of like ethics and morality and grappling with what one does.
I remembered not really liking it, but not minding Felix's performance.
Who?
Isn't that the name of the dude that decides to die?
Oh, sure, sure. See, you remembered something. Even on this rewatch,
okay.
If you put a knife to my throat and said, "Ryan, tell me the name of any of the characters we met in this episode," I wouldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you. I couldn't even tell you. Was the guy a judge or a magistrate? I can't tell you. I'm dead. You've slit my throat. I'm bleeding on the floor. I'm dead. Michael left me behind. I did not like this episode when I first saw it. I remember distinctly it was my least favorite up until that point. What really put me off was the visual of the episode. We've heard this many times in my discussions. I really don't like that brown, murky, looks like we've dipped the camera in a dirty toilet bowl look. And mixed with the special screens that they use, as well as special effects, this episode was truly ugly to look at. That planet or that
nothing
colony
felt
thing.
Real.
It was all fake, unnatural. You could tell that they've plopped this person here in post and plopped this person here. This is probably not the ugliest this show's ever looked, God no, but it is one of the ugliest that it's looked at this point in the season. And I'm looking
I would say that it's the ugliest episode of this season.
Of this season, yes, but not of the series.
No, no, no.
It's not your favourite, the Blue Planet episode, and it's not my favourite, Lethe, the Yellow Planet.
Sanctuary?
Sanctuary was pretty fucking bad. Looking, or any of the Sukol stuff, where it was like black and murky. But
the Dilithium Planet.
Yeah, whatever it was. We'll never visit it again, of course.
No, it kind of collapsed.
Yeah, we'll never touch again. I don't know. They get dilithium from it, don't they? Like his thing collapsed, but the planet's fine.
Or the
what deposit, whatever. We're splitting hairs. I didn't like this. I think it's ugly looking. For a show that is as expensive as it is, it's really gross to look at. And I think that's just a staple of modern sci-fi in a lot of places where you just have to kind of settle for them to have this gross aesthetic that is just of the times. I enjoyed the TV show Killjoys. It's hideous to look at, though. But that show has a really small budget, so the hideousness and the lens flares and the
has an excuse
and the blowout of the white exposure and all of that is to hide things as well as give it that modern look that we apparently like. And so this is just that, but on a far more expensive budget. It's just ugly, ugly, ugly. What was the yum yum moment for you? The moment that stood out as what the fuck, or the whoa, that's out of nowhere, or what a strange thing, or what were they going for? Or that was weirdly funny, but also is it supposed to be? I've got mine. I mean, people, you'll know what it is. I made it the thumbnail of the episode because it really stood out.
I can't be bothered to recollect, so just tell me yours.
Do you want me to tell you or show you?
Show me.
Come on, Rachel, roar back at me. Stop being afraid, Rachel. Rachel, you gonna roar back?
No.
That's the moment. The Taka Saru scream off. What was that? Did that happen? That happened, right? Like when it came up again on this watch, I felt as if I had a traumatic experience triggered because I put it out of my brain. I hid that away. I completely hid that away, and then it surfaced again here, and I was like, I've seen this before. How could I forget this? It's not that I forgot it. I really did hide it from myself. I'm like, I can't think about this again because it hurts. It really, my temples are throbbing at that right now. Like, what was that? What happened?
Okay, so it's bad that Taka does it. Is it made worse, better, or just more fucking weird that Saru actually screams back?
All of it's weird. Taka doing it was weird. I don't know. It's just... It reminded me in part, not as cringy, but of the Giorgio being like, you're Pan in my universe and we had DEFCON level fun together. And it's like, what is this scene doing? What is this? And it all ends with characters being like, well, that was weird. It's like, yeah, it was, writers. Where were you going with this? Oh, Tark is kooky. Thanks. I got that from the pea and mashed potato demonstration already. Remember that great scene? Oh, brother, what a great scene that was.
Make me a plate of mashed potatoes, cold, and a pea. Just one.
We're on a clock here, so if you need to eat something.
These potatoes are the DMA. A mass of dark matter and accreted material moving through space, wreaking havoc, controlled somehow by the device at its center.
None of the plots, but a moment that really defined this and made it the one that I, like, made it memorable to me outside of the hideous aesthetics. The awkward implementation of trying to make minor characters memorable, stand out, or have a moment. Do you want to kind of expand upon that?
Okay. Well, we have the moment with what's his fucking name with the flood thing.
Reese. Your favorite, Reese.
Don't give a shit.
Private channel, Reese. That Reese.
Yeah, yep. That's a moment that happened.
She tried to whip out the private channel in this episode, and then the guy was like, please, no, it's embarrassing.
No.
The guy on the board was like, please leave, Michael. No, it's embarrassing. Stop it. Silly looking. So we have Reese. So what's his whole deal?
He wants to head a rescue mission because one-time Starfleet saved him in a rescue mission.
Okay.
Is there anything else to that?
Did we see it?
No.
Oh. Oh. Why?
We just know that, like, he's competent and has a personal investment.
Yes. So those are the facts. Like, when you lay out what happened, this is what happened. We're going on an away mission, blah, to rescue these people. Reese steps up. Hey, can I do this? And it's like, yes, you can. I can tell it means a lot to you. It does mean a lot. Thank you. I'm going to go off. Don't see him do anything. We don't see him help. We don't see him even guide people in or have a little plot of his own where he gets trapped or maybe he helps somebody. No, no, no. We have him just hologram into Michael, and Michael's just like, this means a lot to you, doesn't it? Again, reinforcing that. And he says, it does. Here's my backstory about some incident I had that loosely connects to this, but mainly is here to let the audience know I do exist, by the way. I am real. Since I've said a backstory, now you no longer can think of me as just that guy. And we don't see him, nothing more of that. Like, just, oh, he's trying to get in contact with you, but we haven't been able to. And that's really it. That's his contribution. But why we are flagging it is there's more to it than just that. It is, what is the intention of the writers here to push on the brakes and bring this to the forefront? Because it isn't subtle. It is very much, hey, look over here, we're shining a spotlight on this character now. So what is the thought process, intention, and overall execution of this for you, Rachel?
We do have other characters. See? I also wonder if it's meant to make it seem less weird when we get the expo dump from Stamets about how he's been working with Tarka's department. It's like, hey, these characters do have lives outside of what we see.
Yeah.
We're telling you about it now because it's relevant and convenient, but see, it's here.
So you think it's there just to let us know that the characters have lives outside of the 45 minutes we see?
I think that's a part of it, at least, yeah. What do you think it is?
Well, I think that's definitely a case to be made. I believe it is what we've talked about since we've started this. There is this weird emptiness to the Discovery ship. We see all of these familiar background faces, and many people, haters and lovers of Discovery, often comment that they want to know more about these people, or they want to see more of these people. They want more of these people involved in a way that I find complex and frustrating, because when I watch Star Trek, there were those characters in the background that I would think that about, but only minorly, and then I'd move on. And sometimes they would bless you with a Miles O'Brien episode in TNG, and you go, wow, that's nice, he's getting a thing, but that was just a nice little thing. I really do think that the creative team in Star Trek are listening to people and trying to appease, because we saw this with Detmer last season, and Owo in season 2 and last season with her holding breath trick. And it's like, yeah, but what about Bryce and Reese? They're here too. What about Arium? And what about Lieutenant Wears Wig? the wig lady.
Not Ariam.
Nielsen with her fucking awful, awful wig that stands out like a sore thumb, again, making this cheap looking and ugly, even though we know it isn't.
We check when we watch each episode.
It's hideous. It's distracting, too, because what does that serve? Does her not being blonde anymore matter? Because, seriously, okay, no, seriously, Rachel. If Nielsen, the actress, has dyed her hair brown, let's just say, or red or black, does that matter?
It's, no.
Like, if you came into season four and that character no longer had that just normal blonde hair, would it matter?
They change Grey's hair without a fucking word, so...
Yeah.
Why not get rid of the wig?
So what's so important about Nielsen that their hair is blonde? This isn't, Yeoman Rand, where she had an iconic hairdo. So in a way, she was defined by the hairdo. Similar to how Detmer's defined by the buzz cut look, right? And the prosthetic. But Owo has different hair this season from last season. Michael has different hair than they did in season. Like, what does it fucking matter? Why did you stick a wig on this lady's head so obviously? And it just sticks out like a sore thumb. Like, you look at it and you zone in. But again, we're getting distracted from the point because that wig is a distraction. They are trying their hardest to appease and accommodate the fans and the viewers. Because it has been a consistent complaint or something vocalized. We want to know more about these fellow crew characters, and I this is their attempt, ham-fistedly, awkwardly, clumsily their attempt. They think to humanize it, and I can't even say them, like this character. It's just this object called Reese. They give it a backstory, and then the audience will go, oh, thank God, they've given Reese a backstory that we can put on Memory Alpha so it looks more like he's a character. But give the guy a fucking story. That's how you do it. Or let him have some fun banter back and forth. Or let him have a
personality.
Let him have a unique moment. One of the many reasons why people loved... Sonia Gomez is because she spilled hot chocolate on Picard. That's memorable. Can I tell you much else about her character? Yeah, sure, she was like a bit of a blabbermouth and a bit nervy and young, but the thing I remember is she spilled that hot drink on Picard and ruined his outfit. That's a moment that is memorable. Guess how many episodes she was in? 2. And I remember her all of these decades later, as do many people, because they gave her a unique moment. This isn't a unique moment from Reese. This is just, hello, my backstory is this. Since we said my backstory, now that you can all applaud and love me. It's like, no.
Yeah. That's how you get a character into my heart.
He's a plugin. He's not a real thing. He's just a program in their script. Add program of manipulate audience to feel something. Why do you think people, including the writing team, are yearning for the crew of the Discovery to be spotlighted more often and to be filled out more often when a lot of the other Star Trek shows didn't really feel the need to do that? Why do you think that is?
Because they don't know how to write properly. And this is their way of trying to do that thing of, you know, making you care about somebody.
Right. But, like, why do you think they feel the need? Like, why does the audience want these nobody characters to be characters?
Because they want something to care about. They want somebody to care about in their show. Because that's part of why we ingest media. We ingest stories to find people that we care about, to see other people's perspectives, to engage in thoughts and develop thematic ideas that either reflect or challenge or engage our own perspectives and principles and values.
You got it. Discovery lacks community. They're all about it in themes and messages, all connection and community and life. But it as a show lacks that. Because Voyager, for instance, doesn't do this, really. They focus on the main crew of characters. And you may not like some of the characters in Voyager, but one of the praiseworthy things about Voyager is it's a warm, comfy show in which you get to spend time with a crew of characters you like. And I think a major factor of that is each one of these ensemble cast shows make their ensemble feel like a big community on their own, that you don't worry about those other crew members that stand in the background or have some minor lines of dialogue, because the ensemble of your show feel like a whole group themselves that are alive, that's enough. You may still want those little things, but you don't need them, because the ship isn't empty. Discoveries is empty. Voyager, they would do activities together. They would hang out. They would go to Tom Paris's holodeck programs and play Captain Proton and run around the ship. And Tuvok will be training these people. And Janeway will be drinking coffee here. And Neelix will be cooking food for people. And they all hate it.
They had lives. They had characterization. They had personalities, which made you feel like they had a life outside of what you see. But Discovery is telling you what has happened.
The best episodes are the ones where they actually do the thing that we're saying that they don't do. Remember the time loop episode with Harry Mudd, where the crew were having a party and letting their hair down and making out and dancing, and all of that was fun. It made the crew feel alive. And in that episode, I didn't need to know who Detmer was as a deep, nuanced character. I saw her having fun, and it told me what I needed to know. TNG can be a cold show to many people, but it isn't, because that crew of characters were fun. They would play racquetball together, or they would watch each other's plays that they would make. They would play poker. Discovery doesn't have that. So you are constantly looking at all of these people in the background, and they're these recurring faces, and you want to know what their deal is, because you don't really know what anyone's deal is outside of plot mechanics.
We've spent 4 years with these characters.
Yeah.
4 years.
And you assume, because these background characters are always lumped together, that they are friends, that they hang out, that they do things. And the show has fed that over the years, like with Arium dying. But again, you didn't see them hang out with Arium. You just got told what they would do. Like, Arium's memories of things is just them sitting at a table talking about activities they do together instead of actually doing those activities. It is mind-boggling, but that's what this Reese moment is here. It is them trying to mend that. But what do they do? The same thing. Tell us. Tell us. And tell us unnaturally, awkwardly, forced. Like how Owo can just hold her breath for this period of time.
I'm unconvinced. I'm like, maybe you're just lying about this so that you can show off your skills. You know, Tilly's out of the position, which means that there's, like, you know, room for another lieutenant.
What you're doing is putting more character onto him than they do in the episode. Because could you imagine if that was a character trait?
I want to make it interesting.
You're trying to make it make sense. Because as it is just bizarre. Because you're having the normal Discovery episodes, like, hey, we're doing Discovery things, da-da-da-da-da, spinning cameras and quips and setting up plots and themes and all of that usual crap that we watch in TV shows. They're doing that stuff, and then there's just that awkward thing of Reese standing up and being like, hello, guys, I am also in this show. It reminds me of Kefa in Babylon 5, when in that first episode they're at the bar with Kefa and they're like, you're my best friend, Kefa. And he's like, I am your best friend, and we've never seen or heard this fucking guy before. And then they proceed to not put in any effort to fulfill that. That's Reese. That's Owo. That's Nielsen. That's on and on we can go. Bryce, or that new guy who's Bryce, you know, like, takes Bryce's place. I don't even know that guy's name. Because Bryce is too busy hanging out with Cronenberg for some reason. That's a worry. That's a concern.
Captain, thank you for letting me do this.
I can tell it means a lot to you.
My town was wiped out by a hurricane when I was 5. Your Starfleet crew got us out. So, I got what this is like for them.
I'm glad you're here, Commander.
Let's get into the main plot, because I think it's the most boring. Michael has to save this colony of people because the DMA is going to wipe them out, basically.
They don't know for sure.
They don't know for sure, but it's most likely going to happen. And this society are a bunch of snooty assholes who do the classic any crime is punished by the extreme, except for not death penalty extreme, just like... you are imprisoned in the most extreme way, type of crime system. Mm-hmm. That's how I got the vibe, right? That's how they work, is like...
I don't think it's everybody, I think...
just political prisoners?
Yeah, but I'm also like, well, it could be everybody because it's a small... asteroid colony.
You tell me they only have 6 prisoners in a group of like 1,200 people, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe. I scratch my head in doubt.
Well, think about it, because it used to be run by the chain, so lots of people would just be killed.
Yeah. Well, they're basically that flowerbed people from TNG who would give you the death penalty for any crime, except for these guys just life imprisonment for any crime, I guess.
I feel like it was like from categories. It's just like, oh, we need one person from this category. So somebody who actually committed a murder, somebody who actually stole something.
Mm.
But I'm like, that could just be the writers going, oh, we need differences in the crimes. So that
we need to show the severities of them and how some are less and some are more, but they're all being judged on the same level. And in turn, it makes you think about the crime, like, law and, you know, punishment systems that we have. And it's like, how does scaling of punishment work, really?
Makes me think of deportation as a crime as well.
Yeah. So, Michael is like, hey, Book, you're depressed. How about you and I do one of our fun missions that happen on that magical year away that the audience never saw? You know, we do one of those kind of fun missions, and it's totally earned because the audience never saw any of those type of missions in that magical year away to get any even fond nostalgia for those kind of capers.
We saw a little bit of a montage. That's enough, right?
Well, there you go. Rachel taught me the montage where it was just Michael on her own, where we saw her hair grow. You're right. You really kicked my ass there, Rachel, right to the curve. I am now deaf as well. You kicked my ass and you hurt my ears. What did you think? This plot.
It's bullshit. It's boring. It's really dull. Never felt like they were in any danger whatsoever, except for the leader, because I was like, oh, he's going to sacrifice himself in some way. I didn't think he was going to voluntarily stay behind.
I thought he was going to be like, oh, my leg, it hurts.
Yeah.
I can't walk any further. Yeah. Save the dream. Yeah. He's Forrest Whitaker. Yeah. In Rogue One. He just can't do it anymore. You thought that? Yeah, that's called some form of screenwriting. Okay, so we've talked about this many times as well. There are plots in these shows where you know what they are and how they're going to play out. Yes?
Yes.
If this was any other Star Trek show, you know it would be a similar thing. They go down, they're going to be fine because they are main characters. They're going to find a way to break out and get them free and have a moralized
justice.
And have a moralizing at the corrupt system that put them there. There may be that one guy who is the nicest one of them all, but actually he is the one that's performed the most heinous crime and he's seeking redemption. It's all generic. We've seen it a million times, but hey, they work for reasons, these kind of stories. They work for many reasons. It's like tried and true. What really rubs me up raw is I don't really get to know any of them, of these prisoner characters. I don't get to know any of them. I don't really feel for any of them. I only get to know that one guy. And even then, I don't get to spend that much time getting to know that one guy before he sacrifices himself. Like, once we get to sacrifice, we get lots of speeches and monologues. Oh, and again, my backstory monologue thing that feels artificial, but hey, that happens a lot in shows. But I was just craving having that banter that would come from all of these wacky criminal characters, and they don't trust Michael, or maybe they do, or maybe there's infighting, and this person's here for this reason, I'm here for this reason, like the Breakfast Club of prison breaks type of deal. But I didn't really get that. What did you get out of this?
Nothing, really. Time passed. It was just like very mechanical in the way that it was, of obstacle, reprieve, cut to other storyline, obstacle, solved, reprieve, and then the gaps of reprieve just got shorter as we got closer to the end.
You really are one of the writers of this show. Because that was you just pointing, people, you didn't see this, but Rachel wheeled out a whiteboard with a bunch of post-it notes on it and was just pointing at each one of them. Because that's just the writer's room. Like, here's the structure of this plot. You really did break it down to its basic elements, because it is as mechanical as that. Like, you can time it almost, of like, okay, bang, 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 bang. And again, there are many episodes of shows where it is that, and it's like efficient.
That fact alone doesn't make it bad.
But the fact that you can feel it, and that you are focusing on the mechanical nature of it rather than the actual themes or message or stories or emotions being portrayed, is bad. It is bad. You aren't even at marveling at it, at least. Like, okay, like, there are some of those kind of things where it's like, I don't feel all of those, but I'm, like, marveling at it. I can't marvel at this. It's ugly, for a start, and really dumb. Like, the bug bombs? Like, cool in a video game, I guess, but kind of silly looking in this apparently serious story. Again, what's the tone, Rachel, of this plot? What's the tone of it?
It's kind of video game like in the sense that it's like serious but meant to also be lighthearted and have quips. So it's like trying to have all of those tones at once. Whereas if you were playing through this as a mission in a video game, that would be spaced out.
I just don't know what there is to talk about within this plot, yet it took up so much time. I want to be like, well, no, let's talk about what it's saying about society at large and how the hierarchy of this culture did this in this way and the commentary that that bestows, but they don't spend time on that. That's something that is in there, but it is only a microbe of an idea in there. The bad guy magistrate, he isn't a character. He doesn't get scenes. He doesn't get to do anything. I noted down, what a thankless role for that actor. Or what an easy role, because all you have to do is just be a guy in a suit with your head tilted back and you're looking down your nose at the other characters. That's all he needed to do. There was no nuances in the debate. There was no complications or wrinkles. It was very much Saturday morning cartoon, bad government guy, poor prisoner people, no real black and white. The black and white comes from, oh, I actually did commit the crime, but like, you know, there is none of that Star Trek-y thing where it's like, well, you know, the Prime Directive says this, so we can't interfere in this way, or this is their culture and it may be wrong, but there is a way that it works and we come up with a solution. There's none of that. It is just a microbe. like, I want to talk about it, but you don't, like, because there's nothing there. Like, I'm looking at you and you're just giving me this blank expression, like, yeah. It exists, but also it doesn't.
No, it exists. It exists with very little substance.
We will not share space with them.
Under what authority are you making these demands?
I am the sovereign magistrate
of a colony that no longer exists. Those people are now under Federation protection. And they're subject to Federation law,
but
as are you. As long as you are on this vessel, I need to remind you that wherever you find a new home, you'll be arriving as a refugee, seeking shelter and grace. I hope you find a more just society than the one you had a hand in creating.
It's just time wasting. This whole entire endeavor is a time waster. You can make the argument that, well, it's supposed to be kind of a character's piece where you're exploring not the society, but the characters affected by said society and how incarceration can be good and bad. And this man, Felix, has found a form of justice for himself here, and that he is punishing himself, and that he has become serene, and in his own way he is at peace with the heinous act that he has committed. And thanks to this imprisonment system, like, he belongs here, and he will now die here most likely.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't deserve any better. And it's like, there's a, like, that's a thing for that character. And the other point of that is Michael makes an ethical and moral decision. Like, it's a choice that she makes, and you don't know whether, like, the episode doesn't tell you outright if it was good or bad, because it shows you enough negatives of it, but also it shows you enough positives. So it is one of those where perhaps it's more about that moral choice that Michael makes of leaving the guy to die. Do you, the audience, agree with that? How do you feel about Michael's decision there? Are you on the side of her, or are you on the side of Book? We, the show, have shown you both beauty and horror in the choice that she has made. How do you come at that? See, that's interesting. See, that is far more intriguing
and
when
again,
I say it out loud.
Another tick for the bingo box. Yum yum circles around to, they had an idea, but the execution.
Yeah, it's like, you gotta fill up the time to get to those ideas. Because this isn't even like they had an idea and didn't do it. This is they had the idea and did do it, but the road up to it was just for minutes, just static noises, nothing, gibberish, just boring hum of the TV in the background, just now think about this moral dilemma, and then that's it. Like, that's not interesting. It's not fun. One of the many things I love about Star Trek is they present you something that seems simple at first, and you go, oh, I think I know what this is. And the best episodes do this, where you go, oh, I think I know what this is. And then you delve into it further, and there's more complications, and there's more raising of the stakes, whether it be in terms of characters at danger or philosophy. What do you get out of this? I always bring this up because it's one of my favorite episodes. It's a title drum, knock it off on your bingo card. The Hollow Moriarty episode of TNG is wonderful like that, where you think you know what it is. Okay, AI program gone mad, we need to take him down. Like, oh, it's evil, it's Moriarty has taken over the Enterprise. But it's more complicated than that. He becomes alive, he becomes self-aware, he wants to live, he makes claims that are, like, understandable, and he justifies himself, and he's no longer that thing that we thought he was at the he and the plot is no longer that thing we thought it was at the start of the 45 minutes. It's a growth. It isn't just that moral question at the end, and before it was just like the one note played over and over and over again. That's what is really bugging me, is this is an interesting thing. For many viewers, it's very black and white, like, what Michael did is wrong. Michael did is amoral. As a captain, Michael should have made a better choice there. But there have been so...
Especially when, like, you know, just a couple of episodes ago, she was mourning over a, like, the few deaths that she had. Like, she managed to save almost everybody, but she was, like, repeating the names of the people who had died because she's like, those mistakes are on me.
But those weren't choices she made. She made a choice here.
Yeah.
Like, again, that's fun. This is fun. Like, you bringing that up, that's actually a really good point. And to the writer's credit, it's showing an evolution in the series of this season, at least, of that conflict that she's having as a character, where she is okay here because it was on her terms. And how does that make you feel as a viewer?
Mm-hmm.
Is that good? Is that actually her maturing in a healthy way or in a way that's worrying? See, this is the meat that I wish the whole story was. I just want to ask you, for your, like, since we're getting into it.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think? Was Michael in the right or in the wrong here? Do you side with her or do you side with Book?
Begrudgingly? I think I end up siding with Book.
Right.
Because I do agree that Felix... I really hope that's his actual name.
I don't know. If it's not, I'll play the Felix the Cat theme every time you say it.
Okay, great. Right to self-determination and control over his own thing. But I'm also like, yeah, but he isn't in a stable mental condition in reality. Because it's just like if, you know, you're liberating a cult.
Right.
And they're just like, no, 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 we want to stay. We want to stay. And it's like,
yeah.
Yeah, of course you want to stay.
Well, he's a victim of oppression.
You've been told, you've been indoctrinated. But we know that this isn't good for you.
Yeah.
Isn't it good for a person in general? So we will step in order to take care of you.
Mm.
Which is where I see, like, Book's kind of thing coming in a little bit. Probably not that deep. It's we shouldn't let somebody die even if they want to die.
Right. And the guy would be also furthered into thinking that they're worthless because they are a victim of oppression. This is an oppressive culture. Michael gives the lecture to the evil magistrate guy, and yet she also let Felix die. So is she any better than the oppressive government that put him there? Because she in turn agrees with what the government said, which is this is a guy who should be left there. Whether it is because they see him as an example to be made and not worthy, or because Michael sees it as like, I'm giving this guy the choice he wants to make, but is his choice one of his own volition or one that's been hammered into him because he's been in prison for like 30 years. It's got a lot of stuff there that you can really mull over because, yeah, I also am not comfortable with Michael's choice because it is one where I agree with just Book's statement of what you're going to just let a person kill themselves.
It's like, it's not guaranteed, but...
It is. You know it is.
Yeah.
As an audience, you know it is.
Especially at that point in the fucking episode. They try and play it up occasionally, but it's like, no, we wouldn't. No, I don't trust that you would be doing this if it was like, and at the last second it moves.
Yeah, there's a whole nuances to it, but they do make they do make points of why Michael's making their choice. There is a time pressure. The guy does seem pretty, on the face value, pretty with it. And he has come to this from a collected space. And, you know, we're talking at it from certain cultural touchstones as well, where this guy's from a different culture, as a, you know, this alien race or whatever. Like, there is that famous episode I bring up as well. Check off the bingo, the Deanna Troi episode. I mean, Deanna Troi's mum, Luxana Troi's episode, where she falls in love with that guy who's from a ritual, like a society that commits ritualistic suicide when they reach a certain age. They get appalled by that idea to begin with, but then they learn more about the culture, and it's like, well, maybe this is like not, and it makes you think about the real world. And so it's like, yes, this guy is committing suicide, but it's like, you know, there are some people, you know, whether you and I are like this, that agree that, well, people who are ill or getting old should be euthanized, should have the ability to be euthanized or kill them, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, and what's the difference here, where this guy's like,
I do want
to, I've come to this, I'm at peace with this, and this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay here, and I will die if that is what is going to happen.
And I do, it does come into it, our perspective, and I think it's worth noting, particularly for international listeners, that now, I think it's every state in Australia has some form of euthanasia laws.
Mm.
And it, like, the one part that I think all of the states have agreed on is that, like, if you have a terminal disease and you are of sufficient capacity, you can decide to die. If you are going to die within the next 12 months from a disease, but at the moment you have enough capacity to go, nah, I don't want to skip out on that suffering.
Right.
You can. And it's just like, well, I suppose, like, you could argue that that's part of what Felix is doing, because he doesn't know what's going to happen with the political asylum, if that's going to work, if that is just going to be a bridge to be more suffering.
But yeah, and also he doesn't feel worthy of even that asylum.
No, he doesn't.
Thus,
he doesn't say anything when Burnham was just like, if you want it, say it. And all of the others are like, yes, I want it. Yes, I want it. Yes, I want it. And he's like, okay, let's go. It's like, okay, you're not making out of this alive.
In the previous eras of Trek, especially TOS, but also in the 90s run, in the Berman years, they call it, there was a diversity of writers who had different opinions, different thoughts, different ideologies, and they would put them in their Trek scripts, and that would, in a way, make Trek kind of special, because it's like, you have a pro-Vietnam War here, you have an anti-one here, we have blah, 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 and you would have episodes that would have conflicting ideologies. And it's like, you could argue that it says that the show isn't streamlined and all of that, but there was always that kind of Star Trekian vision to a lot of these things that kind of melded it all together. While in the current age, we have the same kind of people in charge. So you see recurring ideas, recurring imagery, and things that it makes you question, okay, is this what they think, or is this what they want to? So I'm very happy that we didn't talk about this before Picard or before Strange New Worlds came out. Spoilers for those, by the way, with this. In Picard and in Strange New Worlds, they have characters who kill themselves or sacrifice themselves, and they shoot them and treat them as they're these beautiful things, these romantic things. And it's similar with this guy here, where he looks up and he is, from our point of view, obviously we know he's destroyed and put into the sun, but he is illuminated by this almost angelic light, and he is serene and at peace when he is killing himself. He's killed himself. What do you think about that? Now that we've seen more after this, do you think that's just a thing that I'm looking too closely into?
No.
Do you think it is like this recurring thing, unintentionally or intentionally? Like, it's because it does weird me out that we've had so many deaths like this.
There's no denying that it's recurrent. I don't know what the pattern is exactly, or what it's meant to mean, if anything. Because overall, there's a glorification of sacrifice.
Yes.
So I don't think that's unique to the Star Trek franchise and these shows.
Right, but
I feel like I need to be further away from it to really to figure out what the picture is. Because at the moment it's like, that's a weird coincidence, maybe.
I guess I'd thrown because we have Picard's mother who kills herself, like she commits actual suicide, this guy who commits suicide by staying, and Hemmer who throws himself off because he's going to die anyway, but he does it in this noble way where it's a Jesus pose as he leaps off and it's, oh, it's so beautiful. What throws me is it's the presentation visually. Is for each one of them, visually they're presented as this glorious thing, this nice, sweet thing. Even Picard's mum's suicide is, she's wearing this white gown and there's this kind of heavenly glow to the scene, and it's weirdly romanticized. And same with this guy here, same with Hemmer over there. And it's like, you could say each script is having a certain thing to say about it, but presentation matters a lot because each one of them are like characters killing themselves, and visually it's showing you this as a beautiful thing instead of like a sad thing or a horrible thing. Because realistically, like, at least from my point of view, that's not something you should be shooting and glorifying and romanticizing and giving this angelic glow to.
It's a very dangerous subject matter to be exposing people to, let alone doing it in that light.
Yeah.
Like, people are often upset for the way that, like, suicide in particular is addressed in media. But I don't think anything has caused the same level of outrage as 13 Reasons Why did.
And it was an influence as well. Like, that show was not only divisive, outrageous, but it did influence a lot of culture in TV.
Yeah, you know, there have been several studies that...
Oh, yeah, about the real-world ramifications of it that are very disturbing. But, like, it was a show that did make a mark on TV landscape, and I feel like it did here. I'd love to hear people's thoughts on this, and I would love somebody to do a proper, like, rundown of this, like a proper video essay or even a thesis, because I feel like there is something happening right now with Star Trek with that. I don't know if it's just this watching of it has just scratched, like, a certain thing that I'm like, what is this itch? But, yeah, it just... I didn't see this on the first watch, obviously, but, like, when I'm revisiting it, this is something that's in my brain. It's stewing there. And we'll see as it goes along, because we also know Taka is similar, too, as it goes along, where he's, like, flippant about the whole thing, and there's kind of a romantic thing to him just killing and being killed. It's, yeah, I'm curious, but that's all I've got to say about this main plot. It just is a thing that happened, because we've got to make sure that we go to 13 episodes, and the DMA can only sustain 4 to 5 episodes as a story, but we've got to stretch it out to the 13.
It's his choice to make.
Is there no one left behind?
We have to respect his agency, don't we?
And let him kill himself.
It's a risk, not a certainty.
We have Taka now.
Yeah.
He's a Ryzen.
Yeah, he's from Ryzen.
Yeah.
The pleasure planet.
Yeah, but I'm like, is Ryzen the word for them?
I guess. We should know. We talked about the episode where they went to Ryza and Worf told his tragic backstory about how he killed a kid in soccer.
Yep.
And they went to Ryza, and they had that lady there, Vanessa Williams, I think. Was that who it was? I'm really struggling. That episode sucked.
Yeah,
but
we're going
to see our main cast in some skimpy outfits. Rick was happy that day. Little Twinkie Bashir. Taka. He's a guy. He's just as okay. What do you?
He's like Stamets.
Yep.
But if he never came back, is that what the message is meant to be?
That's actually a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a great way to put it. It's weird that he's only paired with Book for the rest of the series. Considering that they make him such a strong mirror to Paul, they pair him with Book for the rest of the show. And Stamets, as that mirror, doesn't really do anything to comment upon Taka. Isn't that strange? Because it's right there. Like, this episode, I'll pull it back. What did you think of Taka initially? And what did you think of him revisiting here?
How to formulate coherent thoughts and not just say he's a fuckwit.
Well, how about we synthesize some mashed potatoes cold and one pea and you can get inspired from there.
Okay.
So you thought he was a fuckwit?
Yeah.
From the drop?
Yeah. Like,
in a good way or a bad way?
I thought it was kind of fun in moments, and then they would go too far, and I'm like, no, too much, don't want this, clear those mashed potatoes and that pea off that plate, go away.
I thought he was a fuckhead too. I was concerned when I first saw him.
It's just like, is he just going to be a wanker?
I was concerned when I first saw him that he was going to be what he became, which was the supervillain who's actually an evil scientist who's going to use the DMA for nefarious reasons with disregard for everybody else. And I don't find that very interesting because it is just... How many villains in Star Trek have we had where it's like a madman gone rogue with a super weapon? So many times. I am conflicted, though, because as much as I don't like the actual character himself, I love the performance.
Yeah, the perform... isn't with the actor.
No, but he, as the actor, does... some marvelous work where I almost like Taka as a character, but the writing isn't delivering on that. It is purely the actor committed to the role and doing whatever they do. I've never seen this guy before. Apparently he's in The Expanse. I haven't watched The Expanse, but he is great. And I know that a lot of people don't like Taka. Fans of Discovery don't like Taka because he's an arrogant asshole. And I don't like the character. I think he's generic, but the actor brings such a weird energy to it in a good way. Not in a way that is off-putting when it shouldn't be, but in a way where it should be.
I believed in his roar. Not any actor. Mm-hmm. Could have done that. But I believed in his roar.
He makes the cringy lines of dialogue seem natural. There's still cringy lines of dialogue, but he carries it off with such ease.
He embodies his character with such gusto that it was reminding me of an old favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think it is?
No, I don't know. What, Khan? Because I think of Khan, where Ricardo is like so dedicated to the role that you kind of don't care what he's saying or doing. He's just so charming.
I was thinking about Isaacs within Discovery.
Lorca?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. Where Lorca was like a stupid character, but like Jason Isaacs does what you want him to do. I think it's difficult there because it's like, I know Jason Isaacs so well, and I know, like, when you hire him, I know what character it is. This guy, I don't. And so there was that unsure quality to him, because I was constantly throughout this episode, when I was revisiting it, going, oh, man, I really wish that you weren't the guy that they make you, because I was rooting for you to be as unique as the performance is as a character, rather than the blandness and the formulated nature of the script makes the character to be. It's possibly one of the biggest examples of Discovery doing that, where an actor is giving you something of a character that the script isn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's great, and he made the B-plot really enjoyable for me on the performance level. It's nothing amazing, the B-plot. It's just like they're doing tests, and they push the limit too far, and Saru shuts them down, yep. And that's about it.
Has zero weight to it.
Well, no, the actual tests, yeah, it has zero weight. You don't feel any suspense or tension of it.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate that he has a theory and that it's a device and it's propelling the DMA mystery and onwards, where it's like, we know it can move. So logically it means that it's something,
yep.
Whether it is alive or it is a manufactured thing. So he's gone down the manufactured road. He's figured out this, there must be a device in the center of it. And I like that. I think that's interesting, but like
his backstory that we get is implemented so much better than Flood Boy's.
Oh, Flood Boys? Yes, yes. Because even here, through subtle moments of acting, you get why he is doing everything he does. And if you know his backstory...
The dumps that we get in this episode alone of, like, oh, I wasn't understood on Riser, and, oh, there's nothing like, you know, proving a theory.
And I love myself, so I know I'm going to be okay. Like, the guy is egotistical.
I wouldn't put myself in danger.
The guy is egotistical, but also kind of not really. And the comparison to Paul was evident on that first viewing.
They go hard on it as well with the Hugh and Stamets in bed scene.
I know I keep asking this on each plot and each episode, but it is just a question that is the defining critique. Why did they not do this correctly? Because they present him as such a strong parallel to Paul, and then don't have him and Paul together throughout the season. They have him and Book together, which they set up here. Why did they not do this correctly, Rachel?
Because they wanted to do it different. Because it would be too easy. It would be too typical to pair the mirror characters together and see,
have them commentate on one another, challenge each other.
Yeah. But
tempt each other.
So instead, we get Taka as the Dark Path, as the Sith, and Stamets as the Jedi, and Book is the Youngling who, in this analogy, has begun the training because he's gotten his trauma, and now he has to pick a path between being selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And self-centered.
And selfless.
Yeah.
And a hero. That makes sense, actually.
And connected in community, because
that actually makes
Taka
sense.
Gets more and more isolated, whereas Stamets has built a new family for himself.
Yeah. You know what? I know that initially started from a place of, like, I don't fucking care. These writers are stupid. They probably didn't think about it. But like,
I do think that that's what they thought that they were doing.
I think that's genuinely it. Like, I don't know if I agree necessarily that it's the writers trying to be like, it's too typical and blah. I really do think that that is the thrust of it, of like, we want, instead of them mirror characters bouncing off of each other, they are the mirrors.
Fable.
They're the angel and devil for Book.
Yep.
That's actually very interesting because I'm going to look at it through that lens in the episodes to come because I didn't see it that way the first time. I was just like, oh, okay, we're just doing the discovery thing where instead of turning right, we turn upside down and inside out for no real reason. And so to give it credit, I think you made a compelling case and I want to see if it actually holds water on my viewing because that isn't actually a bad way to think about. Like, if you're a writer, that isn't actually a bad way to go because there is a case to be made that the other one is a little too typical and we've already done enough Paul drama the last two seasons. So, yeah, I never thought about it. Now, this all that we're talking about here, isn't it really upsetting, though, that the actual episode is just them standing in a room with a CG thing in front of them saying, more, more, no,
we need
less,
more juice,
less,
more juice, more
less,
juice, more
less,
juice,
less, less, more, less,
no, no,
more,
no, I
less.
Need a kill switch.
Trust me, Daddy Saru, trust me, that's the runtime of it.
We're running an evacuation, but we don't need a captain on the bridge.
No, somebody else had the con.
Yeah.
Saru made sure to give somebody else the con.
Yeah. When he was already the one that was left in charge.
Yeah, but, you know, that's how it works. But it's like, no, you're going to stay up there. I'm going to be down here. Okay. I have nothing else to say about it other than it happened. Like, Jet Reno turned back up, your favorite character.
Oh, yeah.
To collect a check.
Uh-huh. Quips were had.
Not even that many.
No, but
Jet Reno is actually being far more straight-laced in the scene. Just like, I am here to do the techno stuff.
Yeah.
I'll give it some more, Captain. I don't have anything else to say other than it took up time. This is a filler episode in a lot of ways. We're introducing our villain in a rather bland, boring, generic, throwaway affair. There's no real fanfare to the introduction of Taka. It's just like, he's here now.
He's not an upfront villain. He's there.
No, but he is. Did you see that haircut? That's like a villain haircut. Do they think we're dumb? That we don't know that Taka is, like, obviously villainous from the beginning?
Yeah, I think that they're trying to hide it.
You do?
Yeah.
It's not like a Lorca thing where, like, they're obviously, like, he's a villain, guys. He's shrouded in literal darkness because he's a bad guy. I can't tell if they want us to know straight away that he's obviously a villain because they do make him very unlikable, very driven and egotistical and almost willing to destroy Discovery in the very first appearance he's in. I want to know, where are you at with the DMA? This is the season-long mystery. The season-long hook is pushing us along as we go. I just wanted to touch base. Where are you at with it? Because you and I both agree, like, the DMA isn't as bad as the Burn.
No, it's not as stupid. We do get the species name dropped in this episode.
10C.
So we now know that it's the 10C, and it is just like, okay.
This is happening.
Is this tiny asteroid really the only thing that's being affected in all of space right now with this thing that's 5 light years wide or some bullshit like this?
Well, they don't know that yet. I mean, they know that. They don't know what it is affecting.
No, they don't. But like, they know where it is.
No, I know that. What I'm saying is it's in an area of space with nothing much in it. But they don't know why it's in those areas of space.
No. But they don't know that it's a mining
they
operation.
They will later. The DMA is a thing that exists. How are you with it currently?
It's happening. I don't care. It's whatever it needs it to be.
Did you have any theories? Did you have any thought of what this was going to be, who was behind it, any of that?
Oh, I always thought that it was going to be somebody new. And I didn't really like it when they were like, oh, and it...
It can't be, and they list all of these memory alpha entries that could be capable of doing it.
And then they dive into the Q one a little bit more, even though it sounds like...
Mm-hmm. And then the Admiral
leaves. The Q is the most, like, least likely, but they just have the most information on Q.
Well, it's like
continuum
The Q have the power to do so, but it's not their style. And we haven't heard from them in this many years. And then the Admiral looks directly into the camera and said, "Watch season 2 of Star Trek Picard for more Q lore. Q himself will be in it. Watch Star Trek Picard season 2. And then his eyes turn into like hypno eyes, and the hypno toad noise played as the Star Trek Picard theme in the background was whirling around, and you started drooling and saying, "Star Trek Picard season 2, we must watch it." And I had to throw my shoe at the TV to stop from us turning on Star Trek Picard season 2. I think it's better than the burn. It's less silly. They do each episode keep raising the stakes and giving us more information on the DMA, or at least every couple of episodes they do. But like with the Klingon War, it still always feels so in the background, and we don't really see the effects of it as much as you would hope, even though, yes, we know Book is the effects of it. I just feel like, okay, it's a big wibbly wobbly invisible thing that I'm not really sure of at all. Oh, it's driven by somebody else. What nerdy thing will the writers pull out their butt? Will it be Gary Seven is operating it? Like silly things like that. Rather than me actually caring about who it is, it's more what piece of the canon will the writers pull? What piece of the franchise will the writers pull out their butt or not? Because
plug in memory alpha into this random website generator and, oh, look, it's taking us to this subpage.
Right.
Let's work that in.
Let's work that in somehow. Let's just reference it. If we reference it, the audience will like it.
Let's have a challenge.
That's what the C stands for. Intense C. Challenge. Oh, Rachel's smiling at that one. See? I can make Rachel happy sometimes, guys.
You gonna make me happy by letting us stop this conversation?
The C also stands for cash, and David Cronenberg fucking loves money. I have nothing else to say. I just wanted to really hammer in that David Cronenberg is in this show getting money. Just, there's no other reason for it. He doesn't care about the material. He doesn't like Star Trek or love it. He's just here to get money so that he can make more films. And I love that. Fucking love it. You see it in his performance in this episode. Just, hey, I'm here to get money. Okay, I gotta go now. I'm not taking off my fucking glasses. Screw you. I adore him. I appreciate him. I find that season 4 of Discovery was better every time he appeared on screen. I'm glad that they gave him more to do this season. And thus we lead into the Hugh Dar, because I know everybody is screaming, what about Hugh Culper? Guys, Hugh had stuff in this episode. There's lots going on with Hugh, and you haven't said a single thing about Hugh. Why? Because we leave it for this part of the show, Hugh Dar, where we zero in on Hugh Culper, go into what we got from him this episode. And we got a bunch, Rach. We got a whole storyline with Hugh. Do you want to kind of break it down, run through it for us?
Did you know that in the cultural consciousness, there's this big concern that's happening? You know, a lot of people are dealing with, a lot of people are having difficulties with. And, you know, two things that come up a lot are, mental health.
Mental health.
And burnout.
A burnout. Not Burnham. Burnout.
No, burnout. So I think, you know, Star Trek Discovery writers are just doing their best.
They write what they know. Mm-hmm. They're burnt out and they have mental health problems probably.
Yeah. So they're shoving that on Hugh because, you know.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Because he had an existential crisis in season 2 that abruptly stopped.
Uh-huh.
So let's bring it back.
And, you know, also, we've noted many a times that, you know, this was produced and created and put out during the earlier times in this pandemic.
That's why David Cronenberg couldn't be there on set with him at the same time. That's why he was a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
Blinking, glitching every 2 seconds.
Absolutely.
To remind us he's a hologram.
That's why. And there was a huge thing. A lot of people have paid less attention to as the pandemic has gone on, which is the mental health of healthcare workers.
Oh, yeah.
And all of those things are being brought in to Hugh.
Yeah, they've brought those things onto Hugh, and it's not a bad idea. If Hugh was a counselor longer, I would appreciate this more. But he's been a counselor for 2 episodes, and they're already like, hey, dude, you've worked yourself to the bone off screen. Again, if this was Deanna Troi and it was season 4, yeah. But this is Hugh, season 4, in his 2-episode arc of being the ship's counselor that we've had. They're tying it into these previous things of him being dead and how he's got survivor's guilt. Why is he alive? All of that. And he's burning himself out. He's burning the candle at both ends. This is really compelling. And I like this. I like that they're bringing this to Hugh. But there's a caveat with this.
Uh-huh.
Show us Hugh feeling these things.
Show? No. We need to tell you. We need to tell you. No montages of seeing anything for you. Just tell.
Did you get this sensation either this watch or the last when David Cronenberg like lays out what's happening with Hugh? I got the, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be getting out of Hugh? It felt as if this was like new information for me, the audience, instead of a culmination of things bubbling to a climax. Like, technically, all of these things have been there, but like, to me, it's just like, Cronenberg comes in and says, hey, Hugh, and our audience, this is the thing now, by the way. And I just shrug and go, oh, okay. Did you have that at all?
Mm-hmm. A little. The other, like, I don't know. For me, it was more like when they were setting it up. I'm like, oh, yeah, they do the burnout thing. And then nothing really happens with it.
Yeah, what goes on with him in the season with this burnout thing? Does he...
I don't know. I don't think they really do much with it because, you know, they don't do much with Hugh. You know, this season we're getting a whole lot more than we have in the past, but it's still not a whole lot.
Wilson Cruz is trying.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
He's doing his best. He gets a gold star
Sometimes the directors need to tell him to pull back. And they don't.
No.
There was that whole monologue he gave where he started to kind of whimperly cry, and I thought it was too much. Not the crying, just the bar he went over for it. I was like, no, pull it, lower this energy a bit. Because
this feels like you're working a bit too hard to get to that emotional space, so I'm seeing the acting.
This was a 15th take, because you know it's really the 15th take, because he has to start squeezing his hands to make himself cry. I noticed that. It reminded me of Tom Cruise in, I think it's Magnolia, where he had to squeeze his hands so that he could feel something to make his eyes water. Wilson did a little bit of the squeezy trick there, so I saw that.
You see him as a performer.
That's the issue. I saw the performer rather than the character. And I was happy for the performer getting stuff to do rather than the character getting stuff to do. I think, you know, I'm past Hugh. Like, I want to keep doing the Hugh Dar because it's a fun exercise. But when we first initially did it, it's because it's fascinating to look into Hugh. But now it's like, yeah, they did nothing with this guy. And after a certain point, you're looking at nothing. You're looking at zero. And now they're giving him like physical material, like we can point to and go, that happens. it is too little, too late, and I feel like I'm still looking at a void, shaped like a man just walking around. And I do wonder why him. It's a great question. Why is Hugh Culber being focused on? Like, in this episode, can you tie it into the rest of the stories going on here? Why is he being focused on?
I don't know.
Why are they bringing this up in this one? How's it connecting to any of the other things happening? Is it? Or are we just not seeing it?
I'm definitely not seeing it. So I don't know if it's there or not.
Coverage told me I'm wearing myself out.
He's right.
Said I'm using work as a crutch. And that I need to take a break.
Maybe that's why I fell in love with you. We have the same pathology.
Making you either a total narcissist or a glutton for punishment.
Little column A, little column B.
Are you ready to give a rating in all of that out of Yum? Yum being bad, Yum being good. Where do you fall on the examples?
It's a Yum.
Do you think we're going to give a Yum to any episode this season?
I don't know.
My
bet would be a no for me. You might end up giving one.
I'm more charitable than you.
Yes, you are.
And that's because I grew up in a little town in rural Australia that had a flood one time. Please clap. Please clap and give a 5-star rating and review. Because me mentioning that made it worth the time to pause.
Congratulate Ryan on various social medias. You can find our account.
Oh, wait, Rachel, I'm going to give my rating.
Yum Yum Podcast.
Rachel, don't skip over it. I'm going to give my rating. I'm going to give next week's episode. I give this, actually, you know, we've talked a lot here about things that were far more interesting than the episode. So I'm going to be charitable and give this a yum. Because it would be uncharitable to give it a yum yum because that would be a pity. Yum.
Stormy weather is the next episode. Seeking answers, the USS Discovery ventures into a subspace rift created by the dark matter anomaly. Meanwhile, Book faces a strange visitor from his past. Ghost Dad.
I actually forgot who the strange visitor was. Oh yeah. I can't wait for Ghost Dad who, oh boy, there's a lot of thoughts, a lot of takes. I've got some things to say about Ghost Dad. Not the movie Ghost Dad with Bill Cosby, but no. I mean, I have thoughts on that too if you want to hear them. But we don't have time. Unfortunately, we're running out. We've kind of burnt up a lot of time giving away personal backstories. We could have allotted it better, made this conversation a bit smoother if we didn't include all of those moments to clap for those amazing backstories, but we're out of time. We don't have enough time to talk about my thoughts on the film Ghost Dad, but we'll talk about Ghost Dad character next episode. You can find all of our social medias in the description below. We are always posting on there. Feel free to follow us, to engage with us. You can email us directly at yumyumpod@gmail.com if you want to drop us something over there. That's much appreciated. We have a Patreon in which you can pay to have some extra bonus content. Rachel, what's happening over on Patreon?
Well, our coverage of Ghost Dad will be coming out soon.
Every
right?
week we do Ghost Dad. Like the worst idea of all time podcast. We do that, but for Ghost Dad. Where we watch the same movie once a week, every week for an entire year and try to find the new redeeming thing about it. But no, what is happening over on Patreon?
Well, what do we have going on? We are watching some movies. We are talking about the Aliens franchise.
Yeah, we talked about the X-Men franchise and the Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
Remember Star Trek?
Yeah. Like, we've been doing the Patreon pretty much as long as we've been doing the main feed podcast. So we have a vast back catalogue. which does include coverage of the episode of Deep Space Nine that we referred to where they go to Risa.
Mm-hmm. And as well as Strange New Worlds and Star Trek Picard Season 2. All of that is there. If you join the Patreon, you get to be a part of the group Discord. You get to converse with other yumlings and get the joy of getting some fun Walker Smith thumbs up gifts directed at you from Babylon 5. So that's a joy.
And sexy Jakar gifts.
And sexy Jakar gifts.
Always got time for sexy
so
Jakar.
If you have the means and the inclination, please come over and support us on Patreon. Yum Yum Podcast on there. That is all. We are done. Please, guys, clap. Please clap. That's how we end this episode, Rachel. Come on. You and I clap together. Come on. We're married. Let's clap together. Come on. That's why everybody's here. Everybody's here for our adorable couple energy. That's why, and Yum Yum, of course, that's why they're also here.
Yum.
Ooh, guys, she said it. Yum Yum.